Okay, so here we are. The government finally gets it, it seems. The stock market, well, it moves both up and down. So today, let's talk businesses, what they are going to do and what that's going to mean for us. From American Public Media, this is Market Plans. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Tuesday, today, the 17th of March. Good as always to have you along, everybody. The state of businesses in these coronavirus times coming up in a second. First, though, a brief swing by the macro economy with this listener question. Remember, you can tweet them at me, at Kai Rizdahl, or there's a link at marketplace.org. Anyway, here you go.
This is Eric Margulies in Chicago, Illinois. We've been hearing for months about an impending recession. Now that we're in one, or about to be, is this the same recession we've been hearing about, or is that shoe yet to drop?
All right, lots in there, Eric, so let's unpack this just a little bit. First of all, the recession that has been in the wind, it's been there in part because we have been in the middle of the longest boom this economy has ever seen. Here's Andrea Eisfeldt. She's at the UCLA Anderson School of Management.
Whenever we're in a boom, there's an impending recession because we know that we experience business cycles in the U.S. economy.
Which is to say, economic booms and economic slowdowns, neither of them last forever.
You know, now that we're in recession, I don't think we need to expect that the initial recession will come on top of the corona-induced recession that is primarily being driven by the health shock that we're experiencing.
So that, Eric, is the basic answer to the question. The recession we are in right now, because we are, is the recession, right? Whatever was going on in this economy before, like 2 to 3 weeks ago, recession-wise, that is so not important right now. Now, it is worth mentioning that there are different kinds of recessions and recoveries. You probably heard me talk a lot about a V-shaped recession versus an L-shaped recession. Not official terms, mind you, but still illustrative.
Well, when you think about a V-curve, it is exactly how, you know, a fairly sharp drop and then a fairly quick and speedy recovery.
And on the other hand?
An L-shaped recession is an even steeper decline in real activity and a very prolonged recession.
See also the Great Recession. The key to understanding, though, where we might be headed, L or V, is understanding the difference between the two.
We do know some things about the deeper recessions. Those recessions are the ones that seem to come along with credit events, so corporate defaults, corporate bankruptcies, as well as layoffs.
And if you understand the difference, then you know what to watch for. And some of those things that Andrea was just talking about, the layoffs and all that, they have started to happen already. Andrea Eisfeldt, again, she is at UCLA's Anderson School of Management. One more nod to the Great Recession here before we get on with things. Anybody recognize this voice?
If you've got a squirt gun in your pocket, you may have to take it out. If you've got a bazooka and people know you've got it, you may not have to take it out. You're not likely to take it out.
Anybody? Anybody? Henry Paulson. Back in the last economic crisis we had, Treasury Secretary, of course, Henry Paulson, explaining what it was going to take to calm things down. I mention that and I play that clip because today the Trump administration came out with its version of a bazooka, almost $1 trillion in stimulus, direct cash payments to Americans being a big chunk of that. Much negotiating, of course, to do on that one. So, you know, more to come. Okay, same general gist, new topic, though. How our technology infrastructure is going to handle so many more people working from home, not to mention all the learning from home that school kids and college students are going to be doing. Data caps and internet access is what we're talking about. And when we talk about things like that, we get Molly Wood on the phone. She's the host of Marketplace Tech. Hey, Molly.
Hey, Kai.
So data caps, data limits, sometimes they're called, have been like the Bible for online usage, internet companies for like ever. That now has like all of a sudden gone out the window.
That has gone out the window. Most major ISPs in America have lifted their data caps. And of course, this is the thing where if you use too much data, you pay an overage charge. Mm-hmm. And when it's your home broadband, it might be, you know, 250 gigabytes, for example. When it is your cell phone service, it might be much lower if you don't have unlimited data. All of a sudden, everybody does have unlimited data. And ISPs have said for nigh on a long time, two decades maybe, that we need these caps to prevent congestion on the networks. It's been one of their big arguments against net neutrality regulations, mm-hmm. for example, that they need mm-hmm. to be able to manage networks in this way. But for the most part right now, the internet seems to be working fairly well in an unlimited fashion for a lot of Americans.
So were they just fibbing? I mean, you know.
I think that there have been times when these arguments were very legitimate. For example, on mobile networks when they were sort of growing, when mm-hmm. we were first mm-hmm. rolling out 4G, you know, there were congestion problems. Congestion certainly exists on networks. But the simple fact is that in terms of value, sort of gigabyte for dollar, the United mm-hmm. States has had some of the most expensive internet speeds in the developed world. Advocates have been looking for the data to say that these caps are unnecessary. And after this, they're going to have it.
Having unleashed the beast now, as it were, any going back?
I don't think so. I mean, I think this is, you know, a couple things are happening in the middle of this giant, unplanned, very abrupt experiment. Yeah. One is that we are seeing that the internet really is a utility. And mm. that has been something that advocates have argued about for a long time, that we should classify it that way and treat it that way. And absolutely not. You're not, it's going to be very hard to take away this kind of access once people have had it. And frankly, there's no ongoing economic argument
right.
for it. You can hear me trying to be professional there.
Yeah, no, I get that. Look, you got 20 seconds to answer this question. What are mm-hmm. the odds that it will get regulated as a utility coming out of this period of economic disquiet now?
I mean, I think we really are going to see some changes in the way that we look at this. The digital divide has got to be closed. We knew that going in, and it's going to be more obvious than ever now.
Molly Wood, she's the host of Marketplace Tech. Also with me, a podcast we do called Make Me Smart. This week's episode is education and distance learning, and in part, the internet infrastructure that we are all counting on to support that. Molly, thanks a lot.
Thanks, Kai.
On Wall Street today, the big telecom firms did all right. Also, though, a whole lot of other companies did as well. The volatility was to the upside. On this Tuesday, we'll have the details when we do the numbers. So look, it can't be all work when you're working from home, and it can't be all learning when the kids are distance learning. So Universal Studios has a plan. Its cinematic releases, we have learned, are going to go straight to streaming, beginning with Trolls World Tour on April the 10th, the day it was set to open in theaters. Films that are in theaters right now, Emma and The Hunt, for instance, might be available for streaming as early as Friday. Great for consumers. Really not so great if you're a theater owner here or internationally trying to stay in business during a pandemic. Marketplace Jasmine Garst has that one.
The Invisible Man, already in theaters, is one of many Universal titles that will be available on streaming.
He's not dead. He has figured out a way to be invisible.
For about $20, you can watch it at home. But will people pay that much? Mike Hodel is an analyst with Morningstar.
What the studios are banking on is that going to the theater costs you probably three or four times that amount once you factor in all the stuff you buy at the concession stand plus the ticket price.
Hodel says some movies are still better left to the big screen, action films like The Fast and the Furious, which Universal postponed till next year. But Trolls World Tour could be a good test. It's aimed at kids who, you know, might just be driving parents forced to work at home a little crazy. University of Miami's professor Arun Sharma says,
it may be a good strategy for them to just do experimentation and see what works. And at the end of this, they may have a sense of what the volume is the price point the correct price point.
He says if Trolls is successful in homes, other studios might follow suit. But what does that mean for movie theaters? People were already staying home and streaming. Will they want to go back out after this?
They want to be free. They want to socialize. We are human beings who do not take kindly to being confined.
Analyst David Tarsh focuses on travel and leisure. At some point, he says people will want to head back out, get some popcorn and a really good seat. I'm Jasmine Garst for Marketplace.
The theme of the day today, businesses and how they're doing, continues now with another question.
This is Meg Phillips in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. I'm wondering, what happened to small businesses and workers put out of work by COVID-19 in China? Did they get government support? Did they starve? Did businesses close?
Marketplace's Jennifer Pack has that one from Shanghai.
Some firms have gone out of business, but we don't have a full picture of how bad things are yet because the economy is still recovering. There is government support, like cheap loans and cuts to payroll taxes, rent and utility fees, but, and there are lots of buts, payroll tax cuts are helpful only if the company was paying the full amount to begin with, and many small firms weren't. Rents will come down only if your landlord is a state-owned enterprise, because guess what? Not even the Communist Party can order a private landlord to collect less money. What the party can do is entice banks to lend more, but small firms often have little to no credit history, so banks find them too risky to lend to. As for workers, there are a lot more people out of a job now, but they probably didn't starve. Why? Because the savings rate in China is about 3 times what it is in the US, and food is cheap.
Coming up.
So I have all my tuna, my soup, cans of sauce, a lot of pasta, rice, potatoes.
Stocks are up today, but stocking up is also up. On that note, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial's up 1,048 points today, 5.2%, closed at 21,237. The NASDAQ shot up 430 points, 6.2%, 7334. The S&P 500 rose 143.6%, 25.29. McDonald's down 0.9% today. Restaurant Brands International, purveyor of Burger King and Popeyes, dropped about 0.7%. Yum Brands, also KFC and Taco Bell, are under its umbrella, shed 6.2%. Amazon, which is seeing a surge in online orders amid the coronavirus, is going to prioritize shipping essential items like food and medical products. Amazon shares closed the day with a 7% rise. The 10-year Treasury note, the yield there, just going to squeeze this in, up to 1.07%. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Ryssdal. We talked yesterday on the program about how the coronavirus is hitting the services sector pretty hard. Neil Cairns, our bartender up in Portland, Oregon, told us about how his bar is cutting back his hours. And in fact, not long after we aired that conversation, the governor of Oregon ordered bars and restaurants to close for anything other than takeout. Same thing's happening all across the country, especially after New York and Los Angeles shut things down as well. So how, do you suppose, is the restaurant industry dealing? Marketplace's Justin Ho is on that one.
Back in February, the Taiwanese restaurant 886 in Manhattan started seeing a steady slowdown. Co-owner Eric Z says the drop-off in business was manageable at first. Then, last Thursday, New York City declared a state of emergency.
And then just, poof, nobody came.
Z says by Friday, revenue was down 80%. That cut directly into the cash he uses to pay his employees, buy supplies, pay rent. A restaurant like his doesn't have a buffer to sustain a hit like that.
You're operating on crazy, crazy thin margin.
On Sunday, Z closed down the restaurant and sent employees home. That same day, Emmeline Zhao, who manages Little Tong Noodle Shop, shut down one of her 3 Manhattan locations. Zhao says the restaurant industry is already risky. Something like this can be devastating.
And we're seeing only the beginning of it, and it terrifies me.
New York City's Department of Small Business Services is offering businesses grants and zero-interest loans. Greg Bishop is the department commissioner.
That money could go to anything. It could be to install a point-of-sale system. It could be to do something different than they normally would have done.
A group of independent restaurants around the country is offering discounted gift cards. They call them dining bonds, and the idea is to keep cash coming in. Other restaurants are trying different strategies. Steve Chu runs a restaurant called Akibin in Baltimore. He's now focusing on app-based ordering and delivery, and also bleach to keep the whole process clean.
Like, our door handle used to be black. Now the silver's definitely shine.
At 886 in New York, Eric Z will start selling beef noodle kits you can heat up at home.
So I'm heading in after this call to prep, actually.
Z says he'll use the proceeds to pay his employees who are now out of a job. I'm Justin Ho for Marketplace.
In grocery stores pretty much everywhere in this country, two contradictory things are happening. Lines are getting longer, while at the same time, for now anyway, shelves are pretty well picked over. Marketplace's Mariel Segarra has been talking to you about what you're buying, why you're buying it, and how you're feeling about that. Because it turns out right now, a lot of you are trying to walk a fine line. Here is the coronavirus installment of our series, How We Shop.
The other day, I visited Lindsay Garfield at her studio apartment in a tall building on the Upper East Side of Manhattan. She's 30, works for a commercial real estate company. Her apartment is only about 400 square feet. Not a lot of room for stockpiling, but she's doing her best. She showed me into her tiny kitchen and swung open one of the surprisingly large cabinets.
I cannot reach the top, but I do have a stepladder. So I have all my tuna, my soup, cans of sauce, a lot of pasta, rice, potatoes.
She has also stocked up on bottled water, yogurt, avocados, Lysol.
Like having all the stuff, I guess, makes me feel a little better. Like, oh, I'm prepared. I have food if I need it. I have all the cleaning supplies. I'm doing my best. I'm washing my hands. I'm sanitizing my apartment. And that's all I can do.
She says she's not sure how prepared she needs to be right now. And she's trying to find that line between overdoing it and underdoing it. That's been a real personal dilemma for Dan Haggerty, who's 32 and lives in Reno.
Some people in my family, particularly my father, will occasionally go out and stock up whenever he believes there's an impending crisis. And it always just seems to be kind of a waste. And I've always just kind of rolled my eyes at it.
Recently, he helped his father move, and they had to throw out this old plastic jar of applesauce.
I didn't know applesauce would change color, but it did. It turned almost like a dark brown. So I was kind of disturbed by that.
But about a week ago, as Haggerty saw the shelves emptying quickly, he gave in, filled up his cart with 9 or 10 packages of toilet paper. The thing is, it is rational to buy some extra supplies right now. Miranda Fleischer is 48 and lives in San Diego with her 11-year-old daughter, Penelope. She's gone shopping several times over the past couple weeks, filling her cupboards and her fridge with food. She says she has to be prepared. If they get sick, there's no one who can really help them. Penelope's dad lives an hour away. He has diabetes.
And he's just generally not as healthy as we are. He's a wonderful guy. He would normally be here in a pinch to help us out, but I just wouldn't ask him to.
Same goes for Fleischer's mom, who's 76 and lives in Indiana. Fleischer says she's struggling, though, with how much to buy. She wants them to have enough food so they can stay home.
If it gets bad in San Diego, which I expect it will, the fewer times we have to go out, I feel like the better. I just want to help flatten the curve, as they say.
But she doesn't want to hoard either. And neither does Alan McDougall. He's 54 and lives with his wife, his 15-year-old son, and their 3 cats in Connecticut. He's been buying extra food and toilet paper, but he's being careful not to overload his cart. He's bought stuff like kimchi ramen, which he loves.
Like the other day, I went into the store and there were 6, so I bought 3.
He wanted to leave some for everybody else.
If I take the last one of everything I think I need, you know, someone else is just not going to have anything. And I don't want to be that person that puts somebody else into that position. I think you need to think about the people around you.
This weekend, he did go back and buy a few more. I'm Mariel Segarra for Marketplace.
All right, let's take a break from pandemic news and forecasts of a grim economic near-term future, shall we? Because sanity, right? There is a pretty standard roster of tech companies that comes immediately to mind when you start thinking about the biggies, right? Apple, Google for sure, Facebook as well. But there is another that belongs on that list, a company that is bigger and more profitable than most, and you're probably using some of its products right now, whether you know it or not. Jeffrey Cain's new book is called Samsung Rising. Jeffrey, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me, Kai.
I would like to begin with a line, a very brief snippet from this book in which you say this. To most, Korea's success rested on Samsung's success. That is how important this company is to this country.
Yes, that's exactly true.
Samsung Electronics, just one company within the bigger Samsung group, makes up about 20% of South Korean exports. And I, you know, when I was a reporter in Korea, we got an offer to visit the Samsung campus. Hmm. And as I toured this company and spoke to these executives, I started to get really fascinated with who these people are, because it's a major company that makes just about everything in the technology world. They make semiconductors, they run a theme park, they run hospitals, they sell life insurance, they have credit cards. It's so prevalent in Korea that Koreans call their country the Republic of Samsung, and that's really what prompted me to write about this company more.
And it started 90-ish, 80-ish years ago by one family that still controls, basically, right? The Lee family?
Yes, the Lee family. It was started in 1938 as a grocery store and a dried fish and vegetable import-export company. So completely unrelated to what they do today. But their success over time is what helped build Korea. You know, Korea as a nation would not be what it is today without a handful of companies such as Samsung, Hyundai, LG, and SK. These are called the Chaebol, and it roughly means wealth clan in Korean. It refers to a family, a massive family conglomerate that makes just about everything.
Hmm. There are corporate struggles and internal problems as Samsung tries to grow outside of South Korea. What was the moment? Was there a moment where they caught on, as it were, and became this force, or set out on the road to become this force that they are today?
So there were a couple of moments. The first major moment was when they started making semiconductors, and this was a long time ago in 1983. The other major point, I would say, is back when Apple and Samsung were still good friends.
Right.
This was in the mid-2000s when Samsung signed a deal to supply the parts for the iPod and later the iPhone. And this allowed Samsung to, you know, forge an alliance with Apple while also setting out to compete with it. And later they went on and released their own smartphone called the Galaxy S that really just angered Steve Jobs and prompted him to sue Samsung in more than 50 lawsuits that spanned countries all over the world. In the end, Apple did win the lawsuit in the U.S., but it was a Pyrrhic victory because both sides, you know, spent a lot of money on legal fees. And I've spoken with many analysts who think that the lawsuits really didn't win anything in the end, despite the victory on paper to Apple.
So setting aside for a second that whole unfortunate episode where they had those phones that caught fire, right, and they handled that terribly, let me get you in this last question to the subtitle of your book. The South Korean giant that set out to beat Apple, we've already talked about that, you know, they did fine, and conquer tech. I mean, they're the biggest smartphone maker in the world. They're a huge conglomerate. Did they conquer tech?
I think that they've conquered it in the sense that Samsung has such a stranglehold over so many major businesses that if you really want a reliable semiconductor or if you really want a reliable processor unit, a lot of times Samsung is really the best and even the only option at certain times. So in that sense, yes, they did conquer tech because of their focus on hardware and because of just the sheer scale they have. They are the second most profitable technology company in the world right now. Recently, they were the most. Apple overtook them. Mm. And it's always been a battle between Apple and Samsung over who's the most profitable. But maybe it'll be Samsung again in the future. Who knows?
You know, it's so interesting. I've had this book sitting on my desk for probably 10 days or 2 weeks. And I'm just now noticing that the cover, which says Samsung Rising, but behind it is an Apple of Apple computer logo fame. Totally fascinating. Jeffrey Cain, it's a book called Samsung Rising. Jeffrey, thanks a lot. I appreciate your time.
Thank you.
If you want to read more about Samsung's rise to the top, we've got an excerpt of Jeffrey Cain's book at marketplace.org. This final note on the way out today, a ray of personal finance sunshine in an otherwise bleak economic landscape. Tax day has been postponed. Treasury Secretary Steven Mnuchin said so today at the White House, made it official, a 90-day grace period. Interest and penalties are waived as well. Eligibility is people who owe $1 million or less. That's not have $1 million. It's owe $1 million in taxes. And companies that owe $10 million or less. So for my tax person, if you're listening, I'm going to reschedule my appointment. All right, we got to go. Good day today on Wall Street, numbers-wise. Everybody was in the green. Our digital and on-demand team includes Kerry Barber, Samantha Fields, Ben Hethcote, Sarah Menendez, and Erica Phillips. Sar Nieves is the executive director of On Demand. I'm Kai Ryssdal. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.